What's up, everybody? Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. Today I have an old friend, one of my first guests I ever had on this show, and still till this day one of the most enjoyable people to talk to and share ideas and thoughts with, James Corbett. If you haven't been to CorbettReport.com, please do. One of the best sources for news and information and research on historical events and current events and all the above. So please support his stuff and check it out if you don't know what it is. If you're a fan of this podcast, I'm sure you probably have heard of James Corbett because he's been on the show multiple times, and I really enjoy his stuff. He did some really great documentaries. He's been on, I think the last couple times he's been on the show, he talked about his How Big Oil Conquered the World documentary, which is really interesting, and on YouTube and on his website for free. So please check that out. And also Century of Enslavement, about the history of money and history of the Federal Reserve. So please check out those documentaries, two of my favorite documentaries of all time. He does amazing work. I'll keep this intro short because you don't want to listen to me. James Corbett is amazing and always thoughtful and always has really interesting perspectives and always gets me thinking. So hopefully you get the same out of this podcast. But I will remind you, if you want to support the show, I did start a Patreon page. If anybody wants to support the show, all the money goes to the podcast and keeping this thing going and keeping my music project, which you hear in the podcast, the intro music and outro music and all the music in between, is my Theory 6 music project. So if you want to purchase that anywhere where there's digital downloads, that money also goes to supporting the podcast and all that good stuff. So like I said, I'll keep this one short, and I know I usually say that and don't do that, but this time I promise I'm going to actually keep the intro short. It is a video episode, so if you're downloading this and if you actually want to see our good-looking faces on YouTube, go to our YouTube channel, RV Theory 6, or just search for the Ripple Effect Podcast, and you'll see the video version of this episode where you can actually see me and James have the conversation. So thanks again, and I'll see you guys soon because I got some more shows coming up. I have some free time in my schedule, so I'm trying to get as many shows out as possible before my job completely consumes me of all my life and energy. So talk to you guys soon.
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Yeah, you can't complain. Trying to continue doing podcasts with two little critters running around the house.
It's always fun, isn't it? Well, I can very much relate.
Yeah. How old are yours? Your kids now?
My boy is almost 4, and my girl is almost 1.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. So, my boy's 2, and then he just turned 2, and then my girl's 6 months. So
that's right. Yeah, because I was thinking last time we talked, you only had your boy.
So. Yeah. She's 6 months. So does it get any easier having 2?
Not yet.
No.
I'm thinking it might in maybe in a year or two when they can start playing together more.
Yeah, that's what everybody says. Everybody's like, you know, if you have multiple kids, once they get to the age where, you know, they can play together and they won't necessarily need the parents' attention 24/7 all the time. But damn, it gets harder. It's amazing. I don't know about you, but it's funny because like having 2 kids, when you're only responsible for one, like if the wife has the other one, like one kid feels super easy now. And I'm like, how did I ever complain about only having one? I'm like, this is so easy.
I see my little daughter crawling around, you know, just taking things out of drawers and whatever like that, and I'm like, oh yeah, that was what my boy used to be like, and I thought that was a lot of work. It really wasn't.
Oh, that's exactly how I am. I look at him like, I cannot believe I thought one kid was a lot of work. Like, it's a vacation now. Like, if you're only responsible for one, it's like, oh my god, I got the day off. It feels like one kid is a lot of work, and they say like 2 kids is like 1,000 more, you know, more work, and it really is. But it's challenging, but it's almost the challenge is what makes it fun. Like, I don't know if you ever watch the kids on your own without your wife. I'm sure you do at times. And, you know, it's a challenge because you're constantly doing something. And I remember one time my sometimes co-host Dave was at my house and my wife was working and we're talking, he's on the couch talking, and I'm constantly like picking up toys and then giving my son his sippy cup and then, you know, oh, I got to change my girl while I'm talking to him. And he's just laughing. I'm like, what's so funny? He's like, it's crazy, man. Because he's like, I remember those days. And he's like, when you're a parent, you don't even realize it, but you never stop. You're always doing something. And then at the end of the day, you're like, why am I so tired? I didn't really, you know what I mean? You don't feel like you specifically did one thing that made you really tired, but you just never stop. So it's just a combination of endless things that make you tired.
Yeah, that's it. And you never get a moment to just rest. I mean, there's always something going on. So yeah, you're very tired at the end of the day. And that's like me, because I have for the longest time done a lot of the work on the website at night. But I just physically can't do that anymore. I take my boy to bed and get him to sleep, and then I'm ready for bed. There's just no way I can continue working at that point. So
you just, you're run down and you're, So what do? You do work in the morning now or
I do work whenever I can.
Yeah.
Like right now I've got an hour or two, but I just have to steal it whenever I get, the chance.
Yeah.
Well, it's working for the most part, but it certainly gets in the way of sort of the bigger project, documentary type of projects that I like to do. It's really, really difficult to work on those right now.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like the nice thing about having your own schedule is that you kind of can try to squeeze it in when you want it gets hard, and I can see how people can get stuck in this, people having kids, younger than us, and then having kids. Now you work a job, you're forced to work a job to support your family, and then you're in this unfulfilled job and you're depressed because now you have you're concerned about your kids, so you're not really concerned about your dreams and your desires or whatnot. And I can definitely relate to that. Glad that.
Yeah, I mean, I think about that a lot, actually. Like, if I was working a regular 9-to-5 kind of job, I don't know how I would do this. Like, it would be just, I mean, not the website. I mean, like, raising children.
Yeah.
It's just so intensive, so work intensive that, I guess I'm just a housebound right now. It's all I can think about.
Yeah, no, I hear you. But I completely understand. My wife, we kind of sacrificed a little bit because we told, me and my wife was supposed to go back to work, and then she didn't. And, she's like, oh, maybe I'll work part time, because I really liked having her home. And I liked the fact that, at almost all times, the kids are either with me or my wife. They're not at a daycare. They're not with strangers. They're not with whatever, because we're going to give them the type, nobody gives your kids the type of attention that the parents will, and the love and really focus on their progression and how they're progressing and what they're learning, and try to get them to actually, consume some information. So it just, to me, it just seemed like, it's a sacrifice worth making. But like you said, we live in a world where, before, our parents or our grandparents, like they lived in a world where you could live off one income and that was doable. You had the wife to stay at home, and that's where a lot of the laws that are very favorable towards women come from, because the alimony and all that stuff came from when women basically didn't work. They sacrifice a career or learning a skill to stay at home with the kids. So if they divorce and the male leaves them hanging, they're out in the workforce at whatever age, in their 30s or late 20s, without any skills, without any, so it was like looking out for them. Now things have changed where, most households, two people work, and then who ends up raising the family or the kids, and like you talk a lot about this, the state ends up raising the kids or our crappy public schools or so the parents end up having a very little influence on who their kids are, who they become, what's influencing them. And even if you are around your kids often, it's very hard to be the biggest influence in their lives because they're consuming TV and they're around other kids and all this stuff. So it's the society that we've created, it's just, it sucks. I mean, when you really think about it, you're working an unfulfilled job. Another thing you talk a lot about is debt. I mean, we get kids in debt early, give them credit cards before they're even in college. And if you don't have, if not, then when you're in college, you come out of college with this giant debt, which means you have no flexibility to like, okay, I don't like this job, let me go do this, or let me, you know, hey, I always want to do a podcast. You know, I don't have any real debt. I can afford taking some months off and maybe try to build this podcast or this website. People don't have that flexibility. You're caught in this cycle real quickly in life, and then you're stuck there. And then we just become these zombies of working, consuming, and working and consuming. Yep. And then you buy things like a big screen TV because it makes you happy for a little bit, you know, because you hate your job and you're unfulfilled. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. It is a vicious cycle. And I think the key word that you use there is created. This society has been created, and it's done in ways subtle and not subtle. And they all combine to make the world that we see. I saw a nice imaginary Twitter exchange the other day between an 18-year-old and the U.S. government. The 18-year-old saying, "I'd like to drink a glass of wine," and the U.S. government saying, "No, that's irresponsible. We won't let you do it." "I'd like to get $50,000 in debt for my education." "We encourage that." Yeah. I mean, it's always the incentives and the laws and the framework and the structure that create the system that we are born into in a lot of ways, and it just seems as natural as water to the fish. It's just, oh, this is just the way it is. But no, it isn't the way it is. My parents had a substantially different outlook on what life was and how you achieve what you want to achieve and what that means and what dreams you have. They're all completely different. And I'm not saying that it should be completely static forever. I mean, of course, we're humans, we're changing our goals, and things are changing, technology's changing. That's fine. But to not have that perspective, I think, to not understand that what we are in is an engineered society that has been engineered to be this way, that's the dangerous part of it. Because if we get caught in the mindset, it's just the way it is, what are you going to do? Then we basically give up authorship of our own lives. We give up the authority to act and to make things happen differently. And again, I bring it back to my own personal experience, because again, I'm doing this podcasting for a living. Like I don't even understand what that is or how that is. It's something that literally was inconceivable to me when I was in high school, thinking, what am I going to do with my life? It literally wasn't even a thing at that point that I could have thought about. So, I mean, that's a wonderful thing. That's an amazing thing. That's a, hey, you know, things can change and who knows where it's going to end up. That can also be a terrible thing if we just stumble into it unconsciously. And I think that's the key part about all of this. It's about our consciousness and the way we approach the world. Are we passive observers or are we active people who take a part in making things happen?
Yeah, that's why I can't stress enough, and I'm constantly telling listeners, I'm like, if there's something you that sparks a desire for you to do, or you know, you find happiness in any hobby, anything, pursue that. Because so often, you know, at a young age, they steal any opportunity to pursue things that make us happy. Because what ends up happening is that they kind of guide you towards the direction of financial wealth. It's like, oh, you know, you should be this because, you know, it's, you'll make good money doing this. You don't want to do that. Well, you know, why are you studying philosophy? There's no money in philosophy. You know, it's like, what's more important than the ability to kind of examine yourself and the world around you, you know? And so it's just, it's so interesting, because what ends up happening is you end up, like we talked about, you end up getting these people who, instead of at a young age, like, and I don't know what your opinions on like the Montessori schools, but my, you know, I've thought about it and I've looked into it, and it seems different in a good way, where at least it's focused more on creativity and imagination, which, you know, you hope will provoke more thought and imagination in a kid, you know, compared to just testing and all that nonsense in public schools. But, you know, kids at a young age, we're all creative. You know, like, I write music, and sometimes I would have people tell me when I was still playing music, oh, how do you write a song? You know, how do you, you know, that's, I could never do that. And I'm like, we're all capable of being creative. When we're kids, we all play with blocks. We all paint. We all draw. We all imagine we're playing cops and robbers or whatever. You know, so we have imagination. What ends up happening is little by little, that's stolen from us. Or people tell us that part of our brain isn't really useful to be successful or needed. So, and then we focus on, you know, just the stuff that they tell us to focus on. And then, you know, our ability to be creative and provoke thought and look at things outside the box is kind of gone. And you look at the best musicians and writers, they all seem a little bit, you know, a little different. And what we mean by different is they don't think like the rest of the sheeple. You know, they're seeing things from a different perspective, which usually sparks and creates really interesting work or things, you know. So it's a, you know, I feel like, and I remember when I had the amazing Jonathan, he's a comedian, and he talked about his dad hating his job, and his whole life, all he remembered was how much his dad hated his job. And the second he retired, he croaked. And, you know, and that happens. And that happens because what ends up happening is that job, you know, consumes all your energy, all your best years of your life, everything from you. And then when that job's gone, you realize, like, even though that job sucked and you hated it, that's all you had. And that's because we created a world where you didn't have time to focus on, I enjoy welding, or I enjoy sculptures, or I enjoy, you know, doing this or doing that. Like, you know, I didn't have any other time in my day besides doing this job. Now, even though I hated that one thing that occupied all my time, that's all I had. And then you end up dying an unfulfilled person. And, you know, we don't get to hit the reset button. We don't get to do this over again. And, you know, I'm glad I'm starting this podcast very positively.
It's getting deep.
But yeah, it's sad when you really, and I think these bigger pictures that you talk about, these bigger ideas, are so important, because this idea that the way things are isn't the way things have to be. I constantly tell people this, and I'm like, you know, this idea, you know, sometimes you talk to people about, like, you know, we could possibly have all that, we have enough technology if we, instead of, and, you know, creating bombs and weapons to kill people, if we created things to do to all the manual labor, you know, all manual labor could be gone. You know, people would have more free time, and, you know, all this stuff. And people are like, oh, that seems crazy. I think it was Douglas Ruskoff who on my show said once that, you know, we have enough technology where everybody could work like a month out of the year, you know, and that'd be it. That's all you needed for manpower. And, you know, concepts like this sounds crazy, but it really isn't. You know, so it's just, you know, I know you're probably not a huge fan of the Zeitgeist movement and whatnot, but I like, the one good thing that they do agree or not agree is the fact that they kind of have the same type of, they're trying to put out the same type of ideas that, hey, the way things are aren't the way things have to be, and we can have a different type of society, and we can mold something different. And this idea that, like, anything different, you know, or too extremely different is bad, and we can't do, you know, I remember when Ron Paul was running, people would always say, oh, he's too radically different. I'm like, why is that a bad thing? I'm like, we keep getting radically the same thing, and it just doesn't work. And, you know, and this goes back to what I actually want to talk to you about, which was some videos you made recently, Obama Legacy of Ashes, and then Trump's Filling the Swamp. And I think both were great because, you know, you're showing that, like, it doesn't matter what fucking side you're on. It's ridiculous. Like, this idea that, like, this whole election is all your fans are going to hate me, because if they listen to this, they'll be like, will you let James talk? But I'm doing you a favor. You're always being interviewed. You're always doing all the talking. It's like,
you're saving my voice. I appreciate it.
For your work. Exactly. And, but, you know, it's one of those things where, like, you know, the whole election, it's like the Super Bowl. People pick a team and they're rooting, and people, you know, and in a way I even enjoyed. I like the fact that it's kind of fun watching, oh, what's the result going to be? But at the end of the day, just like the Super Bowl, I understand it's a game, you know? And what people have to realize is that it's nothing but a game. It's theater, and who is in power doesn't really have any power. And so, you know, I think you making those videos are really, really important, because have you been amazed how people who jumped on the Trump bandwagon, who were, you know, some people were very anti-Hillary, and that's why, you know, they were big fans of Trump. I mean, does it amaze you how many elections every 4 years that people get tricked over and over and over again? And even though Trump is very different than the others, but if you look at what, you know, like your videos were showing, the people that he's picking and who are they linked to and who they work for, it's all the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, I am a little bit amazed, and that's even considering the fact that the first big U.S. election circus that took place after the point at which I was awake and aware and looking at these issues was the 2008 Hope and Change Obama election. Well, actually, the 2006 midterm election was an interesting one for me, because I remember at that time I was I was looking at all of this, you know, Bilderberg stuff and all this stuff, and I'm like, what is this? What's going on? And I remember thinking, okay, the Democrats now have control of the House again, and we're going to see the impeachment trial start. We're going to see real investigations. The committees are going to get underway. You know, this is what the system's about. This is how it's going to work. But then I was listening to this crazy conspiracy radio stuff and people saying, no, nothing's going to change. They're on the same team, blah, blah, blah. And I remember at that time thinking, okay, well, this is kind of an experiment. Will it go in the way that I've been taught and thought my whole life that, oh, you know, okay, so these are different teams and they're fighting against each other and it's real? Or is it like these crazy conspiracists saying, are they the same thing? Are they on the same team? And the first thing Pelosi says coming in as the new speaker, yeah, impeachment's off the table. No committees get formed. Nothing happens. Dennis Kucinich continues talking a good talk. But other than that, pretty much absolutely nothing from the Democrats. And then I was like, oh, okay, I see. And so by 2008, I was not on board the hope and change train at all. I knew what this was about. And I knew that this was just a puppet theater, basically. And I remember watching, especially at that time, I remember watching all of these outlets, these news outlets that had been good during the Bush administration, had provided genuine good reporting, good stories I'd consistently gone to. I remember, for example, at the time in the Bush era, Raw Story was a good website. If you go there now, it is, I mean, BuzzFeed or salon level nonsense. It's just clickbait garbage. But at that time, they actually did have investigative reporting and some good people on their staff, and they did some good work. I remember seeing as soon as Obama got in, it just went nonsense. It just went garbage. In terms of the value of the information that we're presenting, even if it is coming from a left-right, you know, political bias kind of thing, it was just useless information that I couldn't use in my life. I remember Keith Olbermann, when he had his show on whatever it was, MSNBC or whatever, and he would always close it. I think it was called The Final Comment or something like that. He'd close it with this 6 or 7 minute monologue, which generally was pretty well written and pretty well delivered, and sometimes had some really good information in there during the Bush era, again, of course. And I remember that was one of the models that I specifically modeled my Last Word video series on, because I remember thinking, you know, that was really powerful the way you did that. In 6 or 7 minutes, take an issue, really delve into it, you know, articulate it well, don't worry about dumbing it down, just really go for it. And he did that very well. And then I remember the last one of the Bush era, of one of those final comment things, was about the Bush years, 8 years and 8 minutes or something like that, where he sums up the whole Bush era. And it was a really good video. It was a really powerful video summing up a lot of the kind of main points. Of course, not 9/11 truth or anything like that, but, you know, from the mainstream perspective, really getting at the Iraq war and all of the kind of war crimes of the Bush administration. And I had already clicked, I don't think it was the thumbs up, I think it was 5 stars or whatever at that time onto YouTube, but whatever it was, I clicked it and like, yes, this is a good video, good job. And the very last thing he says in that is, but if there's anything that we can look forward to, it's hope. And it was just this, you know, Obama campaign commercial, basically. And I remember just at that time, just instantly I knew, okay, everyone who was on the left is now asleep. And so I knew, okay, so now the right-wing outlets are suddenly going to come alive and they're going to be good. And so now in 2016, I knew as soon as this happens, as this changeover happens, all of those right-wing outlets that were good watchdogs against the Obama state are going to go back to sleep, and the left-wing outlets might actually start doing some work again. And it is really sad to see that. But still, knowing this, knowing how it works, and having watched it happen in front of my eyes 8 years ago, it's still so disappointing to see it taking so many people. And there's always some kink to it. There's always some way to hook people back in. Like this time, it's like, you don't want Hillary in charge, do you? She's terrible. Yeah, she is. She would have been absolutely horrifically horrible as a president. I don't dispute that at all. She would have been a nightmare. That doesn't mean I want Trump. It doesn't mean I think Trump is a good person. It doesn't mean that we have to defend things that Trump does just because he is not Hillary, which is the extent of a lot of the feedback I get from people who can't understand. Why aren't you on board with Trump? Did you want Hillary? Like, that's always, it's always going to come down to something like that. Some hook, some way that they can get you to buy back into the system and to legitimize it in your own mind. And people realize they are watching the shadows on the wall. They are not watching the real things. Until they realize that, until they get that through their head, they're going to be sucked back in time and time again. And I'm wondering if is there a percentage? Is it 95% of the human population is just going to forever be stuck in those types of games? Or can we actually effectuate a true revolution of consciousness? Because clearly, all that work that we did in the last 8 years just got people crazied up for the left-right game for this election cycle, and it didn't. There's a lot of people even people who were supposedly leading the independent media who are now singing the national anthem and nonsense like this when they were claiming to be anarchists. It's just, it's insane. It's absolutely insane.
Well, I mean, you look at people like Alex Jones, who now has become, I mean, it's amazing the fact, I mean, I give him credit. Historically, he's never really been he hasn't been a fan of any president. And now all of a sudden he's the biggest Trump supporter ever. And it's like, what is going on here? Like, don't get me wrong. He obviously has said some things that are a little over the top, but as much research and knowledge that he knows about, the Bilderberg Group, the CFR, all these things that he's researched, his whole life and his whole career, how does he actually think this is going to be any different? It's amazing that people think this guy's Trump is their savior. And I remember putting things on Hillary, posting things on Hillary on the Clinton Foundation, or just tons of stuff. I mean, it's endless, the scandals that she's been a part of. But all posting this stuff online, and people would immediately attack me and assume I was a Trump supporter, and it'd be like, oh, well, do you think Trump is so good? He does this. And I'm like, wait, don't confuse a Hillary hater for a Trump supporter. It's not the same thing. I'm like, I really don't like this person, and I'm just letting some of the fans and people who support her see some of the scandals she's been a part of. I'm like, that doesn't mean I want this person. It's crazy. It's crazy how people actually think he's the savior. He's the second coming. He's going to fix everything. And he's only going to be in office for 4 years, max 8 years. And you think that he's going to change everything in 4 years?
That's the funniest part about this, because that's the exact same thing that I saw the Obama bots go through. Was for the first little while, he's hope and change. Everything's going to change. This is great, blah, blah, blah. And by the end of the 8 years, it's like, well, he can't change everything. He's just one man. He's up against the Congress and everything. There's always a way to rationalize it. And I think we know, how people are going to rationalize this. Oh, he's up against the big left-wing conspiracy. He can't change the system. Well, that's not what you were saying when you voted for him. And you said he was going to change everything, and everything's going to be change-a-lulia. Yay!
I know. And then they justify everything he does. And that's the thing. It's like, nobody can just look at a idea or look at a action and just decide if it's good or bad, or if they agree with it or don't. They have to look at whose side, they're defending, or whose side they're bashing, and then they can continue just defending their side regardless of what, their side does. And it's so frustrating, because it's like, the whole Milo thing. I've gotten in debates with people about, the Berkeley thing. I believe in freedom of speech, and I believe that people absolutely should have the right to say what they want. If you don't like it, I kind of look at it as like a libertarian, point of view, where it's like, if you don't like something, don't buy the product. You don't have to get them shut down or shut down the company. Just don't buy the product. That's the best way of affecting that company. And if you don't like this person, or if you don't like, James Corbett's podcast, then you're probably a jerk. But if you don't like the Ripple Effect podcast, then just turn it off. There's no need to try to get people shut down or whatever, and that's what freedom of speech is for. It's to defend and protect people who say things that are unpopular. There's no need to protect people who are saying the same thing everybody else is saying that is popular, So I think that, you'll hear people defend Milo, what he says. I defend his right to say it, but people will actually defend what he says, just even though he's a borderline lunatic and a walking contradiction. I mean, he doesn't even make sense. He doesn't stay within his own guidelines, but people will defend him just because he's a Trump supporter. And it's just like, people will take leaps and bounds to just protect their side. And it's just, it's so frustrating. And I don't know what your opinion is on that, but the whole
thing. I think you're pointing to a deeper truth, which is that people don't are, it's not like people are looking at issues and rationally from a perspective, okay, so this is this and well this is wrong because of that. People are looking at people are looking at movements, people are looking at labels, people are looking at flags, and they identify with that. So that is the primary identification, and I think everyone is subject to that to some extent. We all have that. It's part of human nature that we want to look for that tent. Which tent do we fit in, and where, you know, okay, so this is my family, this, you know, these are my brothers, so I got to stick up for them, kind of thing. That is part of human nature. We all have that in ourselves, but I think it predominates to a large extent in certain sections of the population who get crazy, I mean absolutely insane with it. And this is where the cognitive dissonance kicks in, and anything that doesn't quite fit, you know, with Milo or whatever, well, it's okay, he's on our team, so it must be okay. And people will wave away anything they don't like, and anything that they do like, they'll embrace wholeheartedly. And it's, you know, I mean, it's a real question of how do you combat that? Given that it is in everyone to a certain extent, how do you really get people to take a look at their cognitive biases and dissonance? I don't know if there is an answer to that per se, or a single silver bullet answer. I think we, for our part, can only keep putting out the message and keep examining information and looking for biases in our own thinking. I mean, there's obviously everyone has them, so we have to continue to be on guard against that and not put ourselves up on a high horse about it. But also, I mean, clearly something, I mean, I don't know about you, I don't know your background and what you believed growing up and kind of things, but I've changed completely in my worldview at least once, maybe multiple times over my years. There's something that can kind of shock you out of your belief system, something that can really change the way you look at the world. And in fact, one of the best articulations of that I saw someone tweet this out recently, and I retweeted it, was something like, I don't understand how people can know about things like MK Ultra and still trust the government. And that's pretty much it. Like, when I started to learn about MK Ultra and 9/11 and all of this stuff, and then what on earth, like, I'm going to support a governmental system? Because I know what is really running the government. It's not, again, it's not the puppet president. It's not. It's the deep state behind it. And now deep state is becoming a word in the mainstream press, and people are talking about it, and it's a conversation point, but they're not seeing the deeper picture of this, which is the president is not really in charge. And when they want to have a big deep state event like a 9/11 to completely change the narrative and to get you thinking and talking in a completely different way, they do it, and they can do it. Why would you ever trust anyone with that kind of power? Why would you trust in that system? And yet people continue to fall back into it, in line with it. It's an amazing thing to behold.
It's so true, because I say that all the time. I'm like, how can we? I mean, I've had Rick Ross on the show, and I'm like, you know, he told his story. I'm like, how can you guys know that this is confirmed, that the CIA was bringing in drugs, using that money for the rebels in Central America, also locking people up for the same drugs that they were importing? And like, things like that are confirmed, you know, things like, you know, obviously the JFK assassination. I think anybody who believes that, you know, the official story is probably mildly retarded, and let's be honest, there's probably no getting through to them. But I mean, I think for the most part, people agree that there's something more to that story. So there's all these things that are confirmed, not, you know, conspiracy theories that we only have little dots and we try to connect. But there's things that we know for a fact, there's more than meets the eye. So the same people who do all this, and yet you still, you know, and like you said, the MK Ultra, the fat, you know, all this stuff that's going on, and yet we think that, like, no, they're probably being honest now, or this type of stuff doesn't happen now. I mean, a lot of the stuff was only found out about, like, Operation Northwoods and all this, only afterwards. So it's like, who knows what's going on now that we're not going to find out till 10
right,
years later,
exactly.
20 years later, you know? So, you know, it's like, you know, I tell people all the time, like, listen, if your girlfriend keeps cheating on you, aren't you going to question her? Like, if she says, no, this time I didn't do anything, but her lipstick smudged and her hair's all messed up. No, I swear, I just, you know, I just went to go get a coffee or whatever, you know, and she's 6 hours late. Like, you know, you're just going to take her word for it? No, like,
well, this is, you see, here's the problem, is that people think that things like that, you know, okay, yes, I know about MKUltra, I know about 9/11, I know about whatever. Yeah, I know about CIA drug running. But that was those people in that time. That was a contingent part of that government. That isn't what government does. that isn't what government is. We get the right people in government and they'll clean the place out and it'll function the way it should by doing what governments should do, whatever that is. And that's the way people think. And no, my contention is, no, this is what governments do. And it is what they have always done throughout history, is use the power of their, you know, the power that comes with the taxation and then the monopoly control of money that comes with that and all of that to funnel those resources into things like, you know, the CIA drug running project or false flag events or whatever, you know, those types of things. That is what governments do. And it can either happen on a huge scale and be rampant, or it can happen on a little scale and be more contained. But that's pretty much your options. And for me, I'm like, no, that's a game. That's a rigged game. I don't want to play that game.
Oh, absolutely. That's why even when the Pizzagate was scandal was going on, and you know, I didn't obviously there wasn't a lot of proof or any real serious evidence. But when people were like, "That sounds insane," I'm like, "No, not really." I'm like, "Have you heard of the Hastert scandal?" I'm like, "This is a Speaker of the House who is you know, look at Jeffrey Epstein, look at the Franklin scandal, you know, look at that documentary. It was a conspiracy of silence that was never, you know, published or never put on TV, which was put together. I mean, there's endless, you know, just examples of this. And then, you know, locally, there's a lot of human trafficking people, you know, on the news. And it seemed like everybody was saying that locally there is a lot of human trafficking being caught on the news. So it's just, I'm like, why does, it's funny how it's always like, okay, that happened, but no, that's too, you know, that's too hard to believe, and that's too far-fetched. It's like, no, I mean, I don't think it is, and I think there's historically there's been a lot of evidence to prove otherwise, and so it's a, I don't know, do you think it's a little bit of, you don't want to believe it, you want to assume that it was an isolated incident, and people like that don't really exist or aren't everywhere, and I mean, the Pizzagate thing, I don't know what happened to Ben Swan. I don't think I've heard anything about any updates since. I don't know if you heard about his video he did. Yeah, and then all of a sudden his social media was down. But all he did was ask questions. I mean, I think that there's nothing wrong with just, hey, saying, I think this should be investigated. And this goes back to freedom of speech. When you can't ask questions and you get in trouble for asking questions, then what is that going to lead us down? Like, what road is that going to, you know, lead us to? It's just, it's really dangerous thinking. People should be able to ask questions. The fact that Pizzagate was off limits and you couldn't talk about that, you know, to me was, there's something wrong with that, regardless if there's something there or not. The fact that people think that there's things that are off limits or too hard to believe, and so we shouldn't talk about it, that reminds me of like this, the 9/11, you know, for a long time, when it was really close to the incident, you couldn't, I mean, it almost, people looked at you like it was disrespectful for you to even bring up the questions, and made it hard for people to spark these conversations. So it's a, you know, I think it's a dangerous type of thinking when we start restricting what we can talk about and what we think is okay to talk about. And
Right. Well, let's practice some empathy here, because I mean, again, I think everyone has their lines, and there are, you know, shape-shifting reptiles in charge of the world kind of things that I think is ridiculous, flatly ridiculous. And I've seen zero evidence for, and zero evidence is presented, and there are people who would hate me for that. Oh, how dare you deny the shape-shifting reptiles? And, I mean, fill in the blank with any number of other theories that happen. So that still, I think, is a card on the table, that everyone has some line that they draw somewhere, and even for me, you know, 10, well, more than 10 years ago now, well, 12, 13, 14 years ago, I looked at people who were talking about 9/11 conspiracies, and I thought, that's ridiculous and disrespectful. I was one of those people. It took me 5 years before I started looking at any evidence whatsoever, because it's just, that's so crazy. So everyone has those lines, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing to have boundaries around things that you don't want to, things that require more evidence to convince you of. It's like in the Declaration of Independence, where governments long established should not be thrown off for light and transient causes. Well, I don't think government should exist, but I like the idea of that. I mean, these institutions, these ideas, these things that have existed for long before you were ever born, maybe there's something to them. Even if you don't understand it, maybe there is something to them. And we don't just throw things away just because, you know, it's the fashion. We, you know, let's think about this a little bit. So I get that idea and why some people, for some people, something like a 9/11 or whatever, that the government couldn't have possibly been involved in that. That's crazy. Because it is crazy to them. It is so completely counter to their worldview. It would require a total transformation of their worldview, as it did for me, for example. So I understand people are hesitant to throw that off lightly. And with that hesitancy, of course, comes the deflection. I don't want to look at the evidence. Don't show me the evidence. If you show me the evidence, I'll find any reason whatsoever not to look at that evidence. I'll look at who's saying the evidence, or, you know, what color the website banner is, or, you know, whatever it is. Anything that you can do to discount the evidence is fine, because I don't want to look at it. And again, I think everyone has certain subjects where it's just like, that's so crazy, I don't want to think about it. So I'm not going to disparage people for having that. But again, the question is, well, how do you overcome that? Because there has to be a point at which you can you can show something demonstrable. This evidence is here. This exists. What are you going to do about it? And how do you shove that in people's faces in a way that gets them to do something? And again, I don't think that's necessarily a decidable question, because I think everyone responds to different things in different ways. I think I responded probably pretty well to people, well, not people in actuality, but on the internet or whatever, doing the equivalent of screaming in my face saying, look at this, this is real, look at this. And at some point I did, and that was for my benefit. But some people are turned off by that, and some people prefer my approach, some people prefer, you know, whoever's approach. And again, I think this is the type of thing where I say, well, we don't need to organize and have some strategic meeting. Okay, everyone should say this and everyone should do that. No, everyone should be who they are and present that authentically. And some people will like what you're saying and listen to it, and other people will be turned off by it. And that chip will fall on where it may, and that's their problem, not yours. So for me, I like to try to put some empathy into this, because I was in that position at some point with all of the information that I now take for granted, and that I probably, now that I think about it, I don't take the time to explain everything fully from the point of view of someone who doesn't believe any of this at this point, because for me, I've been doing this 10 years. I've gone over this a million times. Of course the CIA ships in the drugs. I've done dozens of hours about that. You know, it's a done fact. But for some people, it's still part of that thing where they won't even look at it because it's too much for them. So they need someone to walk them into it. And I think that's the real question, because that is what we are starting to lose now in the hyper partisanization of the social media space and the internet itself, and increasingly so the real world, where people are just absolutely divided along lines by labels, whatever it is, SJW, alt-right, whatever is, you know, the label that people can be grouped into, and just completely put it at opposition with each other. There is very little attempting to understand what the other person is thinking, where their worldview comes from, what kind of evidence they're looking at or not looking at. And that's the conversation we really need to be having right now, because it's my contention that when we break it all down, we're going to find it's not, you know, your neighbor, that evil leftist who voted for, you know, a Democrat, or that evil right winger who voted for a Republican. It's not those people who are controlling the system that is the entire system under which we're all living, and that is clearly not functioning in the favor of 99.999% of the population. It's going to be these people, and you have to identify, you know, okay, so these groups and these people. Until we get to that point and we start to realize that we have much more in common with each other than we do with, you know, whoever, the jet-setting global elite, until we really internalize that and stop fighting with each other, I think it's going to be a mess. And at this point, just given the trajectory and given how much the ball is rolling and given how crazy things are getting, I don't know if there's a way of putting a brake on this process right now. I mean, does it have to come to the point of civil war until people start to realize that this is not the way we want to go?
Well, that's like recently they released there's been some new information about Pablo Escobar working for the CIA, and people are like, "Oh, can you believe Pablo?" I'm like, "Are you surprised?" I'm like, I was surprised that he wasn't working for the CIA before there was any information to prove so. I'm like, yeah. You know, that one of the biggest drug, you know, cocaine traffickers of all time, and he wasn't working for the CIA. You know, that was surprising to me. You know, so this is just, you know, but you're right. It does. it's going to be hard to get people out of these tribal thinking in groups, and it's hard. It's, you know, like you said, the bigger picture is, how do we do this? How do we get people to look at things that they refuse to look at, or see things from perspectives that they haven't been taught to see things from? And these are interesting questions. And I think that shows like yours and mine, and anything that kind of sparks these conversations, you know, you kind of chip away and chip away. And I, the other thing too, is all this infighting. You know, I've had Mariana Venzeller on, who did this, she did this show on Travel Channel called Breaking Borders, and she would go to places like, you know, anywhere where there's two sides, where like, you know, Palestine, and she took this chef, and the chef would make this amazing meal, and she would take, you know, a Jewish person and, you know, a Palestinian, and they would sit together and they would eat and they would talk. And, you know, when I had her on, you know, what I was, anybody who's traveled, and like you know, you live in Japan, you aren't originally from Japan. Even though the culture is very different than where you're from, you probably have a lot more in common with this person that you think you don't have anything in common with than otherwise. I mean, the majority of people, you know, as parents, both of us, you know, we want a safe environment for our kids. We want, you know, a way of making some type of currency so we can support our families. We want to have the ability to pursue happiness, you know, which is always important. And that doesn't mean somebody else's opinion on what happiness is, but what my happiness is, and whatever that is, I should have the right to pursue that. And so, you know, that show was good, because it showed, you know, she also did something with they went to I think with a border police and a Mexican, and they sat down and they ate, and you know, putting all these people that seem completely different, and put them around food and just let them talk and hang out and not necessarily talk about the issues initially, just let them kind of small talk, and they were getting along and they're eating and drinking. And then it's like, and then once you get to the issue, then that's when you see them kind of pick their sides. But before that one issue, they had a lot in common and they could talk, and you yeah. realize, like, this person that you know, that I couldn't put a face to, but you know, I disliked, I realized this person's not much different than me, you know? And I think that's very important, you know, because what they do, it seems like there's all this infighting. So you have the Republicans and the Democrats fighting, and the left and the right, and the progressives and the alt-right and all this stuff. And there's, so all of us are fighting, and then the puppet master is still there just kind of be like, ha, 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 why don't you guys just keep fighting within yourselves when we're still yeah. making money, and international mm-hmm. companies that don't really care about, you know, it's like that movie Network, you know, there is, you know, they don't care about ideology, there's only DuPont and whatever, you know, those corporate, you think corporations care about what religion you are, what ideology you have, if you're a left wing or right wing, like, they don't care about any of that, you know? So this idea that we're all fighting, you know, among ourselves about these issues, which really aren't important, is just exactly what they want.
Yes, it is absolutely what they want. And I think you're touching on what I think is the fundamental problem that we're combating, which is collectivism. It isn't, I mean, the fundamental thing that enslaves people is the idea that you don't treat a person as a person. This isn't a human being I'm talking to with their own individual story and place and ideas, and I like them because they're like this, or I don't like them because they're like this. No, it's they are this, they are that, they're a black man, they're a white woman, they're an SJW, they're a Democrat, whatever label you can effectively put on them to tie them up in that bow. And, okay, I don't need to do anything else with you. I don't need to understand you in any way. I don't need to try to empathize with who you are as a human being, because I've got this label for you. And that is really the problem. That's a problem at the micro level and the macro level. I mean, when we look at the bigger picture. And I mean, this is something I'm going to be developing more specifically in my podcast in the coming weeks. But I, in a way, I regret that the terminology that I've used for so long for the people, the controllers that I'm combating against, or who I'm ideologically opposed to, I've called them globalists. And I think that in and of itself is part of the problem, because globalism is just a subset of collectivism. Another subset of collectivism is nationalism. So people, when they hear, oh, the globalists, oh, it's the globalists, they start thinking, oh, well, then we better be nationalists, because that's against globalism, right? No, that's the same That's the same idea. It's different sides of the same coin. It's still collectivism. You're still putting yourself in this bucket. And because you were born on this patch of land, you are this person. And you share in the, you know, the history of this people and civilization or whatever, because you were born with this particular genetic strain or whatever. It's nonsense. It's dangerous nonsense. And that's why I think naming collectivism as the real opponent, the ideological opponent, is important, because that gets to the heart of the matter. That the real, I think the real solution becomes obvious. It has to be about individuals, individualism, decentralization. And that doesn't mean that I think every man is an island and you shouldn't have any contact. You should be living in the woods like a Unabomber or whatever, drinking rainwater and eating bugs. No, I mean, obviously we are humans. We want to live in communities with other people. But as individuals coming together to form a community, not as a collective that is imposed upon us from up top. It's not a trivial difference. It's a huge difference. And it affects every step of everything we do, our entire mindset about the world and the people that we're interacting with. These aren't human beings. These are this type of person. This is this type of person. And until we understand and rediscover the real sense of community that's been stripped out through social engineering over the past century, for sure, until we start to re-foster that sense of community and what that means. And I think we have the technology for doing that now. I think things like what we're doing right now, connecting in ways that wouldn't, I imagine I would never have met you at all in the real world, ever, in my entire life. I would never have known you existed in any other time frame in human experience and existence. But now, here we are, coming together out of shared interest, out of a shared community that we're forming, an online community, but still a community of interest that we're forming, that we find, oh, you know, this guy, I like this guy. Yeah, okay, we can talk about this. We're coming together right now across, you know, halfway around the world and talking to people all around the world who are part of this community of interest. We are starting to find the way to do this, but at the same time, the big wedge of polarization is coming where, you know, if you're not part of our community of interest, then God, we hate you, and we're going to come and bash your skull in and drop you out of helicopters. Ha, ha, ha. It's a dangerous time. But also, I mean, in a way, a potentially incredible opportunity that we're facing. Again, it's that double-edged sword of it. It's an incredible opportunity that we have right now if we understand what it is we have and what we're doing. But it's also a very easy point for the collectivists to come along and collectivize us into a basket that we don't want to be in.
But, you know, this is just a question, just, you know, just throwing it out there. But is it almost unavoidable that eventually, even if you get people to learn to be individuals, eventually people will come together as groups and eventually establish something, and then we're back where we are?
Yes, 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 yes. But I think, you see, rather than it being imposed upon us because you were born in this geographical location, or because you are, you know, this ethnicity, or you are this gender, or whatever it is, you are this person, and that is who you are, and that's it. These are, I think the idea is, no, I mean, of course we're going to form communities, and we're going to identify, and we're going to get along with some people, and we're not going to get along with other people. But communities of interest is a fundamentally different idea. And up to this point in human history, I mean, just think, even 100 years ago, most people never really traveled that far from where they were born. You know, most people throughout most of human history lived within a maybe 20-mile, maybe even less than that radius of where they were born. They grew up there, they lived there, they died there. That was their community. Like it or not, you know, if there's no one in that radius that shares your particular worldview or your point, you can, I mean, maybe you can write and have correspondence with people, but what are you really going to do? You're going to, you know, have to fit into that community somehow. But we're at the point where, no, we have 7.5 billion people or whatever it is at this point who are all around the world, who are connecting and finding ways to connect with each other, and we can form communities of interest. And that is going to subvert some historical truths that people have taken. Again, the situation we're placed into, well, this is the way it is. It's the way it's got to be. We have to be organized in these, you know, national governments that that's just always the way it's been. No, actually, now the idea of a nation state is really only a few hundred years old. And, you know, I mean, for a lot of human history, that wasn't really a concept that people understood or lived their lives by. And it will not be a concept that people understand or live their lives by a few hundred years from now. It's just that in this particular historical instant, we're there. And a lot of this is developed through technology. Our relations with other people are shaped by the technologies we have for connecting with other people. And so there is a fundamental seismic shift that is happening in human consciousness, in societal relations, that is happening right now because of things like the technology we are using right now to have this conversation. It is happening. And, you know, 100 years from now, historians will look back and write about this era and have some nice pat little narrative, but it's not helpful for us who are living through it, who are trying to understand what's happening right now. But I think we have to at least start thinking in those terms, because the situation we're born into is not the one that has to be. And people have gotten into their heads that the only possible way to fight against this global governmental structure that we see them clearly trying to erect, well, it must be national governments. So we've got to, you know, go Team America or Team Japan or Team Canada or whatever. That's, you know, that's what we have to fight for. And I think it's a false dichotomy. And, you know, again, I keep bringing it back down to this, because it's truly the technology that is enabling new forms of societal relations. And if we are not conscious of that and shaping the way those relations go, then they will shape us. And that is not, I think, a situation we want to be in, because ultimately there are very, 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 very powerful interests who have thought and understood and talked about this for a very long time and know the ways that they can shape our understandings of the world. Read things like Between Two Ages by Zbigniew Brzezinski, written 45 years ago or whatever it was now, foreseeing this type of this current era that we're living through, was foreseen, was talked about, has been written about and analyzed and studied for half a century or more. And until we start really understanding the transformative power of what we're living through and really using that to our advantage, it will shape us. And one perfect example that I think I'll leave you with, because I got to get running along. But one perfect example of that is this new, not just the fake news meme, but the types of apps and browser extensions and things they're rolling out now to help you check, oh, is this a fake news website or is this a legitimate news website? And they're starting to do this, and they're plugging it from various, you know, mainstream angles. And I just did a video about this, talking about a few of them that I've seen people sending me links to, and hey, look, the Corporate Reports on there is one of the most untrustworthy sites on the internet, and things like this. That to me, what that indicates is the fruition of an idea that's been foreseen for at least half a century. People like Brzezinski writing about the fact that at a certain point, if we continue going along the path we're at, people will become so helpless, they won't be able to go outside without a weatherman telling them what the weather is. Oh, you know, it's raining, you should bring your umbrella. To the point where people are infantilized. They're just children who are being told what to think and how to think and how to react and how to do things. And that's what we're sleepwalking into with all of this. And people, good-intentioned, well-meaning people who will think, oh, I don't want fake news, I better get this browser extension that will warn me about fake news websites, are being told, literally being told, what information to look at and what information not to look at. Like, you shouldn't even look at this website because it's just fake. It is fake. It's just a word that they can put on top of information to stop you from trying to validate it. And I understand why people do this and why there is even a value to having watchdogs looking at information and sources and things like that. I understand the value to it. But again, I think people are being infantilized to the point where they are literally now being told, don't look at that website, look at this website, don't look at that website, look at this website. And when people sleepwalk into that, and there's an entire generation that's growing up that's just going to internalize this and think that's just the way the world is. We get told what sites to go to. It doesn't get any better from here in terms of independent cognitive awareness. So again, I think we have to understand what is happening and how it's happening and how it's being programmed into us to have any chance whatsoever to fight against that programming.
Yeah, I think the fake news meme how fast it's picking up and people are using it. I think it's really dangerous and it's scary. And I think the same way, you know, Operation Mockingbird and you know, during the JFK assassination, the whole conspiracy theory and everything that's outside the official story is a conspiracy theory. They're using the same tactics where it's just like, you know, we're deciding what is news and what isn't. And but let's be honest, since the internet has spawned, we understood that, you know, there's always going to be conflicting reports. One website might tell you one thing, another website. Now, who are we to say that this one's wrong and that one's right? And I mean, it really, I mean, you could almost call anything fake news because liberal media and conservative media always are butting heads and have different opinions on the same story, right?
Yeah. That's the point. And that's what some people in the independent media have taken as a kind of victory of all of this, because clearly Washington Post and others spearheaded the way trying to get this fake news meme pushed. And it immediately boomeranged on them. And now they are called fake news by the president, all over the place. They're being called fake news. So it backfired. We win, you know, yay. But actually, I think you're right. Again, it dumbs the conversation down another level, if we can go even further down into the basement. And so now, I mean, yes, CNN, Washington Post, outlets like that, if anything can be called fake news, I would gladly apply it to them. But then it gets people into the mindset that literally any piece of information that comes from the mainstream is automatically fake and wrong. Or actually, even more insidious than that, people will be happy to spread reports from mainstream sources when they're, you know, something that they believe and they want to share with other people. But when it's something they don't believe, then it's fake news. So it is just, again, it's just a label. It's just a word that people can put over top of things to stop thought from happening. And that is the wrong direction for us to be going in, the exact wrong direction for us to be going in. We need to refoster some sort of, intellectualism and philosophizing is never going to be, you know, the most popular activities on the planet. I understand that. But some sort of respect for the type of discourse that used to happen. Go and watch an interview, even a mainstream news kind of interview on like primetime television that aired 50 or 60 years ago. Like, go watch those old interviews like Ayn Rand or whatever being interviewed by Morley Safer or whatever it was. You know, mainstream primetime kind of stuff. But the level of discourse was so much higher than anything you would see, even a lot of stuff that you'd see even on universities or, you know, places of higher learning or whatever. People don't talk like that anymore. People don't talk in fully formed, fleshed out, coherent, complete sentences with multiple clauses and in ways that actually communicate. That people talk in sound bites, and it's getting dumbed down and dumbed down and dumbed down. And now the discourse has gone to the point where you say something I don't like, fake news, goodbye.
Yeah.
And it's a dangerous thing.
That those old clips interesting. I used to do that. I remember when I first got exposed to Ayn Rand's work, and I found it fascinating just seeing her debate and seeing great minds just kind of pick at each other's brain.
Yeah.
And
I don't know why I said Ayn Rand. I just had that particular interview in my head. But I even look at there was some MK Ultra footage that they released where they were I think it was some of the early like LSD experiments that the U.S. government was a part of, and they were just filming like regular college kids. And I remember that sticking in my head because these were just regular college kids, you know, of course, guys in like shirts and ties and suits and everything, and women in dresses and everything, like a completely different era and mindset. And again, just listening to the way they were talking, even before the LSD, it was so articulate compared to anything you would hear today. And it's, That's really one of the scariest parts to me. I don't know. I'd like to think that's just the historical moment we're living through, and that we can somehow rediscover some way of having a more coherent and engaged and interesting conversation with each other. But podcasts like this are, you know, the point where that happens. And I don't mean to make us into something bigger than we are. I mean, it's just little pockets of things like this that I know if I was out there in the audience and not involved in any of this, this is the kind of thing I would want to be hearing. When people, I have the faith that when people hear something that's real and that isn't this stupid, dumbed down soundbite nonsense, that they respond to it. At least I do. And I remember back in 2000, 2009, maybe 2008, 2009. I remember Jon Stewart interviewed Jim Cramer on The Daily Show, and it was like, I see it obviously from the perspective of Jon Stewart, brother of what's his name? He's a Leibowitz. I can't remember his name, but the head of the New York Stock Exchange. Like, clearly, Jon Stewart is not the rabble rousing, you know, guy that people might think he is. No, he's very much a systems man. And the conversation that he had with Jim Cramer was, you know, it didn't go into the real deep areas of conversation, but it was engaging enough, and there was enough of kind of needling and real dialogue going on there, the beyond the kind of soundbite nonsense, that I remember thinking at that time, if I had seen this a few years ago before I started the website, if this was what was kind of the standard conversation on the evening news or those kinds of shows, I probably wouldn't have started the website. Because I would have went, oh, you know, it's okay, so there's two sides, they're arguing, you know, there's some good points being made, they get into some discourse. I remember thinking I probably would have been happy enough with that. But it's just that it's gone so far down, the level of discourse has gone so far down that I don't see this type of dialogue happening in very many places anymore. So at some point, I actually thought, well, I have to make it happen. And I'm glad I did, because it's transformed my life, obviously. But it's just... it's so sad. Well, it's Craig, so sad to
Craig
me.
Craig Ferguson, he was there's a clip in a documentary. I had a filmmaker on the show. A documentary is free on YouTube in high definition called Own and Operated. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's a real good documentary. And he took a clip of Craig Ferguson. I don't remember seeing the clip live or when he did the show, but there was a clip of him talking about how he remembers when he was growing up that we looked up to older people because they're wise and they're intelligent and the wisdom and all the stuff. And he's like, and then something happened where society started celebrating young people, the being reckless and dumb and just enjoy, you know, there's nothing wrong with just enjoying life, but we didn't look up to intelligent people anymore. It wasn't, you know, so it's amazing how, like you said, these debates that would be put on TV with really intelligent people picking at each other's minds, that wouldn't get any ratings now. Now you get one person, you know, a left, a righty, and a lefty, and they're arguing their points with one another, but you already know where they stand, and neither of them are ever going to admit when the other one made a point. And who wants that?
Watch Tucker Carlson destroy this left winger.
So who wants that? There's this guy, Hunter Moss, who's been on the podcast. I'm going to do another one with him, and he's the co-host on the Brian Callen show, and that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to bring people together to share ideas and just have conversations, and he calls it MMA, what is it, mental martial arts, something like that. But it's interesting because it's, you know, and we've talked about this, where it's this idea that we need more people to be able to come together, share ideas, and it doesn't mean that we're trying to agree with one another or we're trying to disagree, but we're just simply sharing ideas and thoughts and seeing if they make sense and if we like them and having conversation and at times disagreeing and at times agreeing. But the simple, you know, point of it all is just provoking thought and getting people to think and analyze what they believe, what other people believe, but more importantly, what they believe. Because like you said, you know, like yourself, I, you know, my opinions have changed, and I say this all the time. I'm like, you know, I don't know what my opinions were on episode one, but I can guarantee there many things have changed to episode 15 or 115. And guess what? They should. And if your opinions are constantly the same, then you're not taking in information and you're not really analyzing, because none of us have all the answers.
Or you were 100% correct on everything all along, and you're a god on earth.
And you need to stay away from those people. Anybody who has, you know, a truth with a capital T.
I agree. Yeah, completely.
Somebody is so sure of something, and you know, they talk like they have all the truth, and you know, they have all the answers. They scare me, because it's like you're not, you know, you can't be right and you can't have all the answers. So to act like you do, I mean, you're obviously already stuck in a box. And you know, so it, yeah. But I know I'm holding you, and you're a busy man. And
yeah, speaking of being a father, I really have to go be a father now.
But thanks, James. It's always a pleasure having you on. And we'll keep in touch. Keep up the great work.
Absolutely. Well, anytime. I really do appreciate our conversations. Let's have another one.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, James. Take care.
Take care. Bye bye.